Welcome to this special hour-long edition of the Campbell Conversations. I'm program host Grant Reher. What you're about to hear is a panel discussion on presidential impeachment among four faculty members at the Maxwell School of Citizenship at Syracuse University. It took place November 15th in front of a live on-campus audience and was moderated lightly by me. The purpose is to provide some context and framing that you might not have heard from the news coverage. The participants, in the order in which they will speak, are constitutional scholar Tom Keck, historian Peggy Thompson, public opinion and political communication scholar Shana Guderian, and leadership and management expert Sean O'Keefe, who has also held top positions in previous presidential administrations. We start with Tom Keck.
So let's start with the framers. Here's what the Constitution says about the impeachment of the president, all right? The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment of and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. As with most provisions in the constitutional text, it is brief. It doesn't come with a glossary, right? It doesn't tell us what any of those words mean, right? And so we have to consult other sources to try to figure out what exactly the framers were thinking about when they wrote these words. The key text is the Federalist Paper number 65 by Alexander Hamilton. And so I want to focus most of my comments on that document. But it's the leading founding era writing on impeachment, right? It's Hamilton's case for why we put the impeachment power in the Constitution and why we designed it the way that we did. So what the first thing you'll see is that Hamilton says that the impeachment process is designed to address those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, right? Or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. One thing that you hear some talk about in the media is whether impeachment requires violation of a federal criminal statute. And the answer, from Hamilton's perspective, is no, right? Criminal prosecution and impeachment are two separate processes. The impeachment process is designed to deal with abuses of power, violations of some public trust, right? They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political. So he's continuing from the previous quote, right, the kinds of abuses of power that he's talking about. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. This power is designed to put a stop to abuses of power that harm American society, right? Not the same as prosecuting somebody for a criminal violation. Then this next part is interesting. The prosecution of them, for this reason, will seldom fail to agitate the passions of the whole community and to divide it into parties more or less friendly or inimical to the accused. This was written more than 200 years ago, people, right? It's not about Donald Trump. So he says that. And then he continues here with that same line of thinking. In many cases, this process will connect itself with the pre-existing factions and will enlist all their animosities, partialities, influence, and interest on one side or on the other. And in such cases, there will always be the greatest danger that the decision will be regulated more by the comparative strength of parties than by the real demonstration of innocence or guilt. I've heard I've heard one or two Republican members of Congress or other figures talking about the impeachment process, but I think I've heard it from a couple members, sitting members of Congress, who've referenced this passage from Hamilton in an effort to say the current impeachment inquiry is a partisan witch hunt. That is like that is half of what Hamilton is saying, right? Hamilton is warning us about the danger both that a partisan faction could wrongly try to impeach an innocent president and that a partisan faction could wrongly try to acquit a guilty president, right? If you read the essay in full, he's clearly concerned with both possibilities. And the context for this passage in the essay is he's talking about why did we assign this power to the Senate, to the House to bring the charges of impeachment, and then to the Senate to conduct the trial. And he says, we considered a variety of alternatives. It seemed to us that such a momentous decision to undertake, that it seemed to us best to lodge the power with the people's elected representatives in Congress. He says explicitly that some folks had suggested holding the trial in the Supreme Court instead of the Senate. We shouldn't do that for several reasons, Hamilton says. The Supreme Court is too small, too unrepresentative, and might have to weigh in on the case again after the president is impeached and removed from office and he gets criminally prosecuted for the same acts, right? Because the constitutional text clearly contemplates both. If you are impeached and removed from office, and if you also violated a federal criminal law, you can then be indicted. And this is a long quote, which you don't have to read, but he says, after having been sentenced and removed from office, then if you get prosecuted, that case might wind up in the Supreme Court, and we don't want them ruling on it twice. Right? So he is, we lodged it in the Senate, the trial power, because it is the best available option. But we recognize that that creates a danger that partisanship is going to influence the proceedings. But it is still the best available option. And we are hopeful that the good statesmen in our Senate will exercise their powers based on a real effort to determine the innocence or guilt of the persons involved. Okay. So in the early Republic, there were several impeachments of federal judges, right? But the first attempted impeachment of a U.S. president is Andrew Johnson. And I'm drawing here on a great recent book about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. I highly recommend it, by Brenda Wineapple. And let me just make a few quick points about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson that may have some relevance for today. So Andrew Johnson, of course, was not elected president, right? He takes the office after Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. Andrew Johnson was Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, but when he ran for re-election, he had selected a Democrat, a pro-union, but nonetheless Democrat, as his running mate in order to shore up his re-election chances. So Andrew Johnson had very different views than President Lincoln, and he succeeds to the office on Lincoln's assassination. And President Johnson abuses the powers of the office from day one, right? At least according to his Republican opponents in Congress, right? They see it as a long, systematic pattern of impeachable conduct from day one. When Johnson takes the office, there are calls for his impeachment. And throughout 1867, there are impeachment inquiries underway in the House Judiciary Committee. They don't go anywhere, right? But there's like the initial steps of impeachment inquiries throughout 1867, right? And then eventually the dam breaks, right? Eventually he does one more thing, right? He abuses his powers one time too many. And then the House impeaches him in 3 days, right? President Johnson illegally fires the Secretary of War without Senate approval, as was required by the Tenure of Office Act, a law that Congress had passed expressly to prohibit the president from trying to interfere with Reconstruction. He then gets acquitted in the Senate by a single vote. Right? Constitution requires a simple majority vote in the House, but it requires a two-thirds vote in the Senate, which is a high bar. Senate comes one vote short. If you read Brenda Wineapple's account, there's three main reasons why the Senate comes up just short and he stays in office. One was bribery. A couple senators appear to have been paid off by the Johnson administration. Two was that there was some sentiment that maybe we impeached him for the wrong thing. He like abused his powers like all year long. And then this one most recent thing he did was not the worst thing he did, but that's what the articles of impeachment were focused on. So some of the senators were raising that as a kind of legalistic argument against convicting him. And three, there were very significant disputes in the Senate about the immediate electoral implications of removing the president from office. When they impeached him 3 days after he fired the Secretary of War, that was during an election year. It was February 1868, right? So if you hear somebody saying we shouldn't impeach the president because we got an election coming up soon, right? That didn't stop them. They impeached him in election year because the violations of the office of the abuse of power was so clear. The vice presidency was vacant at the time. He had been vice president, had acceded to the presidency. There was no vice president. Under the presidential rules of succession, the next in line for the presidency was the president pro tem of the Senate, Benjamin Wade, who was a Republican that many of his fellow Republican senators hated and they did not want him to become president. And he would have become president if Johnson was convicted and removed from office. They wanted the next president to be Ulysses Grant, right? The war hero, the Union general who had defeated Robert E. Lee, who had won the war. He was widely popular. He was planning to run for president. They didn't want Benjamin Wade to be the incumbent president, right? Because then Grant couldn't run. They're in the same party, right? So for direct political calculations, they decide to leave Johnson in office as a battered, bruised, and weakened president for the remainder of his term. And with that, I will turn it over to Professor Thompson.
Let me read you a brief passage from a congressional committee considering some potentially impeachable offenses by an American president. And this is a quote from their final report. The Constitution requires the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. This charge encompasses a responsibility to leave the members of his administration in no doubt that the rule of law governs. For failing to take care that the law reigns supreme, the president bears full responsibility. Sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? He failed to see that the law reigns supreme, and he bears full responsibility. This was the report of the bicameral bipartisan committee on Iran-Contra about President Ronald Reagan. And the question that we can ask is, why did they decide not to pursue articles of impeachment? And that leads to one of the main points that I want to make that kind of builds upon some of what Professor Keck said, and that is that impeachment is not necessarily a legal phenomenon as much as it is also a political one. And Ronald Reagan was, frankly, a very popular president. It was at the end of his second term. And there was a clear sense that in neither house would the votes be available to either impeach him or remove him from office. And I think they were right in that regard. But that raises another question, because in the two other 20th century cases that we have, the case of Richard Nixon, who was not impeached, but who clearly would have been not only impeached but removed from office had he not resigned, and in the case of Bill Clinton, who was impeached but who was not removed from office, we're dealing with individuals who are both in their second terms, and in the case of Bill Clinton, very popular. At the height of the impeachment controversy over Bill Clinton, his popularity, his public approval rating was 73%, and it never fell below the low 60s. So he was very popular. Richard Nixon was very different, but both of these individuals had been reelected fairly overwhelmingly prior to the consideration of impeachment against them. Richard Nixon had carried 49 of 50 states, and Bill Clinton had not even carried a majority, but he had overwhelmingly defeated his Republican opponent, Bob Dole, in the Electoral College. So, what happened? Why were these two cases carried out the way they were? And why, in neither case, did they succeed? Well, the case of Richard Nixon didn't succeed because he left office. He resigned before he could have a formal vote. But there were articles of impeachment voted on by the House Judiciary Committee. And in that regard, it was very different from the case that we're dealing with right now. All of the votes in the House of Representatives, in the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives, were bipartisan. In the case of the Clinton impeachment, there were two articles that were recommended to the House and actually passed by the House. One was that he lied to the grand jury, The other was obstruction of justice. In both cases, 5 Democrats voted in favor of impeachment. On the first article, 5 Republicans voted no, and 8 Republicans voted no on the second obstruction of justice article. I think the important thing to realize, and I've heard this not only in a lot of the literature I've read, but also in some of the commentary that's going on television right now, and a point I want to leave you with, is that impeachment is not an event as much as it is a process. People do not just get impeached because they do one thing wrong. In the case of Richard Nixon, he had been abusing power for years. In the case of Bill Clinton, it was felt that he had been behaving inappropriately for a long time. And so the impeachment, as Professor Keck suggested with the violation of the Tenure of Office Act, was one act too many, but it was not an isolated act. And the other point that I want to leave you with has to do with conviction in the Senate. And Professor Keck talked a little bit about that, but I think there's one important point that I haven't seen a lot of discussion about, but I think we need to think about it and consider it as we are dealing right now with an impeachment case that may well end up in the United States Senate. And that is that although it's one thing to say, let's look at what the founders said and what the founders intended, but we need to realize that the Senate of 2019 is not the Senate of the founders. And I don't mean that in some kind of philosophical sense. I mean it in the sense that the Senate is now popularly elected, and it wasn't in the days of the founders. The Senate was supposed to be a more deliberative and more responsible body, not popularly elected. And this is a point that hasn't gotten a lot of attention from the commentators and even from a lot of the constitutional scholars. So I leave you with that. You may decide that's insignificant, but I do think it's worth thinking about what the implications of that might be. And on that, I turn it over to Professor Guderian.
So I am going to briefly talk about current public opinion on impeachment and what we might see going forward. Now, I'm going to start with the caveat that political scientists are not very good at telling you the future, mm-hmm. but I can tell you a little bit something about the past and about the role of public opinion in this process and more generally in American politics. So public opinion here is going to provide a constraint on elites and what elites can do. And the House can take the kind of public opinion of the people they're representing as a signal as to how they should vote. And this is true of the Senate as well. And so I do think this point about popular election is really important. And it's going to tell you something. I'm not going to predict what's going to happen in 2020. But I think where you might see leverage in the Senate on votes that could flip across, that we might not expect Democrats who would vote not to remove, and Republicans who would vote to remove, are those places in the country where public opinion is strongly on one side or another, and those senators are up for re-election in 2020. So I think that's where you would see some chance of votes you might not expect otherwise. We also should note that public opinion is very much shaped by elites. Most people pay little attention to politics most of the time. And that it makes sense for most people because it's not interesting, it's complicated, and it doesn't affect people's day-to-day lives that much. So how do people decide what they think about issues like impeachment? They're looking for cues from elites from their party. And they trust those things and those views, and they sometimes just adopt them, okay? I think polarization matters a great deal. So one of the things we haven't talked about is how far the parties have gotten away from each other on both policy issues and on what we might call partisan affect. We have a phenomenon called negative partisanship these days, which is not just I identify with my party, but I also dislike people of the other party, and I dislike the other party a great deal. That has grown exponentially in the last couple of decades, and it shapes how people think about impeachment. And the mass media matters in giving us a sense of what impeachment is about, what are the frames around impeachment, and how should we interpret what is going on right now in the hearings. Okay, so we have some lessons from Bill Clinton, right? Clinton approval at the beginning of the impeachment inquiry was about 60%. And I'm going to show you what Donald Trump's approval looked like. It is not 60%. Okay? Throughout the impeachment proceedings of the Bill Clinton era, as Professor Thompson noted, his approval ratings increased. Okay? But the 1990s are a very different time. Right? Again, this idea of negative partisanship is a lot lower. People are maybe less hostile toward the other side. We're dealing with a much more popular president. We have a much less fragmented media system. We are now living in a media system that not only has ideological media outlets on cable, but also where people are just have many more options across the board and many more options to not pay attention to politics at all. I think also we want to talk about the kinds of issues that were being talked about in the Clinton inquiry, while they are connected to obstruction of justice, are people consider them to be more personal in nature rather than about foreign policy and the workings of government. Okay, so how might these things map onto today? So, and this is aggregating over lots of polls, and this is looking at all voters. His approval rating is about 40%. And with his disapproval rating about 55%, and those remaining people don't pay attention enough attention to know what they think about Donald Trump. Okay, so what does this tell us? This tells us we're already starting an impeachment inquiry with someone who's a president who's already overall quite unpopular, except among Republican voters who are still very supportive of Donald Trump. And I think that is worth, and that maps onto their ideas about whether impeachment is okay and whether or not it should proceed. We see lots more up and down in all other presidents' approval ratings. And one thing to note about Trump's approval rating is that it is flat. It goes up and down a bit, but is it much more flat? That is a reflection partially of polarization and of this negative partisanship, that once you decided whether or not you liked Donald Trump or not, that feeds into your approval rating. And there's not much information that's being updated in your evaluation of Trump. The other thing to note is, so I'm showing you two, this is from the Monmouth University poll. Monmouth University has the kind of the longest running time series right now on approval of impeachment proceedings, okay? And they are matching this with the Gallup poll looking at approval and support for impeachment proceedings. Now, I don't love this question. The question is whether you approve of impeachment and removal at the same time. I think this conflates two things, but that's the question they ask. And this is looking from 9 months before the House inquiry for Trump approval and support for Trump impeachment, and then putting that up against historical public opinion data on Nixon. So a couple of things to note. One is that approval of Trump and support for impeachment go together and are extremely highly correlated. If you approve of Donald Trump, you do not approve of the House impeachment inquiry. You do not think he should be removed. However, and this is very different than Richard Nixon, because over time, if you look at Nixon, the support for Nixon impeachment, it goes up and is about the same percentage of people, about 45% of people at the time of the House impeachment inquiry for Nixon thought he should be impeached and removed. That's the same as Trump. What is different is that as people were more supportive of impeachment inquiry, his approval rating dips. So those things are negatively correlated. Okay, so what does this tell us? This tells us that people now, because of polarization, because of negative partisanship, might not be taking in as much information. And the media system is also part of this, right? People can now pick up information about that they agree with, or they may discount information. They may not be paying attention at all. So, but now we have these hearings on TV, or you can stream them. And how that might matter? So the hearings might matter, right? They could give people information to update both their approval rating and their attitudes about impeachment, because we know they go together in the Trump era. Okay, Republicans on the House impeachment inquiry are doing their best to say what happened in the call with Ukraine either was unimportant or this is business as usual, versus Democrats who are giving a very different vision. Okay? We also know that the media coverage is going to affect whether or not people support impeachment, also whether or not they think it's important in deciding their vote. And one of the things, again, I think is worth noting is that the support for impeachment and removal in the same Monmouth poll, if you just break it down by people's self-identified partisanship, is very different by which party you identify with. While overall, 44% of people are supportive, and that has grown a bit over time, only 9% of Republicans versus 77% of Democrats are supportive, and 41% of independents. The growth and the pressure on members of Congress to vote one way or another is going to come from their members more than the other people in their districts. And so whether this moves, independents move, and whether Republicans move is going to determine how many members in swing districts are going to vote.
You've been listening to a special hour-long edition of the Campbell Conversations, a panel discussion on presidential impeachment held at the Maxwell School of Citizenship on November 15th. We'll continue the conversation after a short break.
News from Central and Northern New York is here on WRVO.
A dozen racist incidents are roiling Syracuse University. For days, students have staged a sit-in. The FBI is now investigating the reported racist messages and hate crimes. And now the Chancellor of Syracuse has signed a list of demands at the request of protesters.
Hear it on WRVO Public Media.
Welcome back to this special hour-long edition of the Campbell Conversations, a discussion of presidential impeachment among four faculty members of the Maxwell School of Citizenship at Syracuse University. It was held on November 15th in front of a live on-campus audience. I'm Grant Reher. Participating were Maxwell School professors Tom Keck, Peggy Thompson, Shana Guderian, and Sean O'Keefe. We rejoin the conversation during Shana Guderian's comments, which are followed by Professor O'Keefe. And following that is a brief conversation among the entire panel, moderated lightly by me.
Now, last, I think it's really important to be very cognizant of what this media coverage of the hearings. Most people are not going to watch the hearings, but they may look at media coverage to decide, again, what's the meaning of this? How should I think about it? Should I support impeachment? And then should I call my member and tell them how to vote? The media, they're kind of easy to criticize in this kind of coverage, because what they are covering, so this is a tweet from yesterday from NBC News that says, the first two witnesses called Wednesday testified to President Trump's scheme, but lacked the pizzazz necessary to capture public attention. So apparently you can come and talk about bribery or quid pro quo, but if you don't have sparklers in your hair, or if you don't set things on fire, this is not enough to capture attention. When we get this kind of media coverage that is focused on the horse race, it's focus on criticism of the TV coverage, I think they're doing a disservice to the public. Because most people, again, are not going to be watching the hearings directly. They're going to go to the mass media and say, what should I take from this? And if the mass media is just saying, well, you should take that these witnesses are boring or these ones have, come on, guys, do better, right? This is democracy that in action. We should really be doing better in our coverage. And the last thing to note, again, senators who are up in 2020 and what the approval rating of Trump looks like right now and what it looks like going forward, because this is going to play into their strategy of how, whether or not they should vote for removal or not.
I'm going to follow Peggy's lead, not have slides as well, talking without a net. But I think the reference that Professor Keck made at the very start of the discussion today, I think is really apropos. This is a political question. If it was a legal matter, this could be decided, that this not be decided based on a vox populi position of the public overall about whether or not the guilt or innocence on a particular matter should be the dispositive feature of this. Instead, this is more a question of the depth of support and confidence that the public has in the leadership at the time, the president at the time. And again, it is in the language of jurists, the judiciary, a political question. And that is precisely for the purpose of describing this as something that can be resolved, or should be in the mind of jurists, resolved on the part of the public at large. As you can subscribe to two different points of view of how you define what is the nature of a political question, or you can look at it more from the context of exactly what the nature of the political and politics and its definition is about, which is about us, about the citizenry, and about our view and how we define standards as well as conduct that we will consider tolerable or admire to the point where we admire for the purpose of voting for that particular leadership position. So it is not, when the jurists use the term political question, that they use often to render matters of legal issue back to the Congress or the legislature, depending on the jurisdiction, for the purpose of determining that citizen opinion rather than the politics of the day. It is to render it back based on the dynamism of what we see within the democratic experiment we've been into now for 250 years, for the purpose of deciding these issues on the basis of the disposition of the citizenry about that question, not based on its legal precedent or any other matter. And exactly as I think each of my colleagues here have described, the history on this question of defining it from a legal standpoint is, at best, still unresolved. Of what constitutes a high crime, misdemeanor, bribery, the treason features, every other dimension of what was incorporated as guidance by the Constitution was intended to be an interpretive point at the time in which it occurs by the citizenry, by the public, and our tolerance for that view. It is judicial speak for relegating the issue to the Congress as the appropriate body to clarify public intent and interest of the citizenry in exactly defining that behavior. In effect, the framers left the grounds of impeachment and conviction to the Congress and the Senate to interpret the will of the people in defining what constitutes an offense that is so egregious that removal from office is warranted. And the framers set that bar exceedingly high. The proposition you've got to get 67 votes of 100 in the United States Senate is one hell of a high bar. And it's not something, it does transcend in every one of these circumstances the majority at the time of the occurrence of the articles of impeachment being referred to the Senate by the Congress. In that context, I think it really bears reiteration of a couple of points that have been raised here. In the case of modern history, of Nixon's impeachment or the prospect that it would have occurred, I agree with Professor Thompson, it's all but likely. And more importantly, all but likely he would have been convicted. But based on the fundamental proposition that his own party would not have hung with him, and this is a really significant distinction. I think this is where the political question comes in most distinctively. Because, as Professor Keck described, there is nonetheless, at its origins, Hamilton's view in Federalist 65 was, in fact, that this was likely to be a condition in which the party of the president would, in turn, defend the individual based, not based on whether or not it's a legal issue or not, but on the basis of the politics of the time. And the public disposition is going to be the matter that needed to be preserved best for definition, truly, of whether this applies in the case of the President of the United States. So as a consequence of that, The Nixon question was moot by virtue of the fact that he resigned. And the reason he resigned is because he knew he didn't have the votes. That was a political question. It was a determination on the part, in August of 1974, of Richard Nixon that he simply was not going to survive that particular treatment. So we were denied the opportunity, really, to determine exactly from a, you know, precedent standpoint. What kind of behavior is it that we would expect from the leadership, the national leadership, the President of the United States, that we would consider to be so egregious as to remove, not because of its legal determination, but because we found it as citizens to be unacceptable. So that political question is what ultimately turns on the definition of what is a high crime, misdemeanor, et cetera, going down the line of what was framed in the Constitution. And the definitions of perjury, for example, as described earlier in this panel discussion, were determined to be not applicable in the case of the Clinton Senate trial that was conducted thereafter, and not found to be, he was acquitted of the charge of the articles of impeachment as it pertained to the question of perjury, and a tie vote of whether he obstructed justice or not. But notably, at that time, the majorities on both the House and Senate side, as a political matter, was a Republican majority, with a Democratic president was determined to have acquitted him by 10 of the members of the majority, joining all of the members of the minority. And so as a consequence, that was a political determination, not based on whether or not there was a determination of the application of lying to a federal grand jury or not. This was more a determination that did that rise to the level that we as citizens viewed as such so egregious as to remove from office. And in this particular case, the bipartisan vote, not exercising its capacity to vote in a way that the majority, as Hamilton feared, would overwhelm the position and deny the public opinion in this case. So in this circumstance, I think where we're headed at this stage is it's a near certainty the House is going to overwhelmingly vote to impeach the President of the United States. And it will be largely along party lines. There will be some Republican defectors, but not many. And certainly none or not more than what we saw in 1999 with Democratic defectors. So this is not going to be a big surprise to see, as it was demonstrated in 1999 and demonstrated yet, it's going to be demonstrated yet again in 2019, that there is no prospect that the articles of impeachment will fail in the House of Representatives. In the Senate, however, my bet is we're going to see at least four members of the United States Senate the Republican majority at the time, voting in favor. And it may be more, but it will be insufficient to reach the supermajority. While it may not be enacted in that regard and he convicted for that purpose, it nonetheless, much like the Clinton case, doesn't really turn on the legal question at all. As much like that case, there is little doubt that the actions on the part of the president that will be the nature of the articles of impeachment coming forward are accurate in terms of his actions and in actually conducting himself in a manner that would rise to levels that jurists as well as anyone else in the legal community would determine were a matter of guilt if any of us were to do this. This is an entirely different question because it's not on that standard. It is based on the legal, on the political question. And so the final point, in my mind, is going to be that the effect of this, Hamilton's intent, as very aptly described by Professor Keck, was in order to avoid a popular overrun in one direction or another for any reason that would not be reasoned in terms of the larger public interest and acted upon by the Congress of the United States. And so therefore, it was designed on purpose to be a very high bar indeed. Not because of its legal determination, but because of its political application. But in the course of doing so, what we've seen in modern history is this in so many ways is a definition of what we as citizens will tolerate, what we believe should be the standards of conduct on the part of our national leader. And in doing so, it has been degraded both in the case that we saw in 1999 and yet again will be in this year. We're tolerating a lot more. The debate has become coarser. Our question has become much more about your affiliation and your partisanship and a lot less about what we believe are principles of conduct that we think are worthy of enforcement. And in that regard, we all ought to reflect on that. And that, hopefully, is what will motivate more than four members of the majority to think seriously when the articles of impeachment are brought before the Senate to vote on the conviction in this particular behavior.
Is there anything that any of the four of you have heard from your other three colleagues that you really want to jump in on and quickly comment on? Any of the four of you?
I just want to say one thing. I was a congressional fellow shortly after the Nixon case. I worked for a Republican. So I'm a Democrat, but I got to know a lot of Republicans at the time. And I talked with members of both parties about the Nixon case. We need to realize that most members of Congress, certainly in 1974, I think it may be less true in the Clinton case and less true now, but in 1974, members of both parties took their responsibility, their constitutional responsibility and their representational responsibility, really, really seriously as they determined what they would have done had they needed to vote, and in the case of the Judiciary Committee members of both parties, as they actually had to decide how to vote. And I think what I miss now more than anything is that sense of deep and profound responsibility among members, regardless of party affiliation, toward the process. It has become so partisan. I find that very troubling.
So let me ask a question about us in this room and just where the line is. Mm-hmm. How do we know when it's crossed? The fact that ultimately this is a political question and which politics and the public are going to be the key. How do we figure this out now?
So from two different angles, right, if you're sort of following like public media and political commentary on the current process, right, from one angle, it looks like a textbook case of abuse of power and a textbook case in which what is called upon is for our elected representatives to exercise their authority as statesmen and stateswomen to stand up for the republic and for fundamental constitutional principles, right? It's one of the remarkable things about going back and reading the founding era stuff is like the examples they gave of like Hamilton's writing says, well, like what should we do if we elect a president who starts using the powers of the office to enrich himself and his family? What should we do if we elect a president who sells out American interests to a foreign power? What should we do if we elect a president who starts abusing the powers of the office to interfere with the sanctity of our own elections and therefore preserve his own holding power? They recognize all of those classic examples of abuse of power. So from one angle, that's clearly what's happening. From another angle, right, what you're hearing on some media outlets and what you're hearing from Republicans in the committee, if you've been watching testimony, is that we have a partisan witch hunt, right, in which Democrats are obsessed with removing a duly elected Republican president, and they will go to any lengths to make up false conspiracies about his abuses, his alleged abuses of power, right? So those are like diametrically, it's like our two decades of polarization like crystallized into like one clear moment here. everybody who's a citizen, right, read the stuff and think about it, right? Make your own judgment, right? Don't go by what somebody on TV is telling you to think. Read the White House call summary of Trump's conversation in July with President Zelensky. Read it out. Get together with a friend and read it out loud. One of you be Trump and one of you be Zelensky.
And read the April one, too.
And read it out loud and tell somebody, if you got a third friend with you, tell them to, like, raise their hand if they hear anything that sounds bad, right? Because it is really bad. And that is the edited call summary released by the White House. There's ellipses in it. They left some stuff out. That is their own call summary. And it's really bad. So that's my view, right? But read the documents yourselves, right? We have firsthand documentary evidence and firsthand testimony, right? Read or watch, right? Call up your members of Congress and tell them what you think of them. That's what I would say.
So I think in thinking about what is over the line, you want to think about what is the role of any elected official, right? And the role of an elected official is there to serve the national interest and the public. And to reflect what it is the public wants. And the elected officials are not there to line their own pockets. And they are not there to use their office in order to get favors to win the next election. When you read the transcripts, think about if that were, if it sounds like Goodfellas, there's a reason that it sounds like Goodfellas, right? Because I'm not saying, but I'm saying is a request to do something, right? Asking for a favor of someone when you have the power in the relationship tells you about what is going on. So I'm with Professor Keck. We always give you more homework. Go and actually read and think about what it is you would expect from someone who is trying to do the national interest. And someone who is trying to enrich themselves and interpret what is going on in the transcript. It's not a transcript. It's a call summary. And in the what's in the hearings through those lenses.
I want to point out one more thing. As a historian, we have even less to say about predictions than Professor Guderian said political scientists do. But I want to point out that in 1974, when the House Judiciary Committee voted as it did on the five articles of impeachment, all I'm trying to say is that judgment is really important. After the August 1st release of the smoking gun tape, it was very difficult to believe that Richard Nixon had not committed an impeachable offense. But the majority of the House Judiciary Committee, including a substantial numbers of members of the Republican Party, made that determination before that moment. And this is why I think it's really, really important that we view impeachment as a process and not a single event. We don't know, for example, now, what the charges would be, what the specific articles of impeachment would be for Donald Trump. We're talking about the fact that certainly he will be impeached and, you know, that it's almost certain that he will be. But we don't even know what the articles are yet, whether there will be one article or whether there will be several. So I just think we need to be very, very careful as we proceed further. I do think that there are indications, strong indications of impeachable offenses so far in the documentation we have. I'm not gonna disagree with my colleagues on that. But we don't know what the articles of impeachment will be that will eventually come before the Congress and the American public. So
I'm recalling there was a remarkable chairman of a committee who was on the opposite side of the hill from where I worked, who had a resounding observation whenever debates like this would break out about what the right position is and where everybody lines up on one side or another. And his response, in a southern drawl that only he could affect with great skill, was, "Why ever be surprised when people act exactly as you expect them to?"
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So what exactly the terminology that Professor Keck recited to us from Federalist 65 was a concern over the partisanship that will naturally be inherent within the political parties and within the public overall. And so prompting the better angels of our nature, if you will. And there's no question that this, It is hard to argue the point. I take mm-hmm. Professor Thompson's admonition that we not get a lot of exercise by leaping to conclusions over what the articles will say, but I think it's pretty clear
they're
not going to be good. Mm-hmm. And it's overwhelmingly probable that the Democratic majority will vote to impeach. I think those two points are almost unassailable.
I don't agree. I don't disagree, for the record.
Is manifest exactly what was forecast by Hamilton in this circumstance. We're all we should not be surprised when we act exactly as we expect them to. The bigger question is the one Professor Rear raised at the beginning. How do we rise above this? Because we can, it's almost predictable in terms of how this will go. And yet, is that what we really think of ourselves? Is that what we really think is how we want others around the world to see this?
Yeah.
The impeachable offenses, if you get down to the political question of that, is the lack of standing that we have across the globe now for the things we have always stood for and now no longer seem to.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that ought to be the point to reach into, define the answer to his question. What is it that we think will be an intolerable level of behavior on the part of any president?
Yeah.
Having set the standard that lying is okay. You and I can be convicted and sentenced for that. President of the United States, precedent says, no problem. We'll deal with that. We don't want the disruption. That's what was determined. And by each of these precedents, we are degrading what we stand for, what the principles are that made this whole experiment possible in the first place. And by degrees, we are minimizing that. That's something that ought to be part of the public referendum next time around.
Mm-hmm.
Let's either all rise up and say, yeah, we're willing to tolerate this for as long as it takes, regardless of your party affiliation and who you are. Or we say, no, we got to rethink what it is we believe are the standards. We want to be manifest that defines who we are.
Thanks for listening to this special presidential impeachment edition of the Campbell Conversations, a panel discussion held on November 15th at the Maxwell School of Citizenship at Syracuse University. I'm your host, Grant Reher. Please tune in again to WRVO Public Media for more conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.